Okay, so what I'm going to talk about, very much from a sort of plasma physicist point of view, is some very basic physics that goes on in perpendicular shocks, okay? And just use PIC simulations to explore that. As I say, it's the very simplest picture that I'm going to talk about, and I'm doing that partly in order that it's easy to communicate it in sort of less than half an hour, because there are always lots more physics you can put in, and it's quite useful to kind of look at the minimum physics and then think afterwards, well, how much extra stuff do we need to include? Okay, so that means I'm going to be looking at perpendicular shocks, 1.5D, which means everything varies in one space direction, but you can retain all the vector information. And so basically, I'm going to describe the standard picture of perpendicular shocks. But there's going to be a slight twist to this in that I'm going to look at what happens at higher Mach numbers, which is, of course, what we want to know. And then you get a modification of the solutions. Okay. So what will come out of this, I'm really looking at the kinetics of the shock itself. So it's how you heat the background ions up to suprathermal. It's not about how you do subsequent diffusive acceleration, Fermi acceleration, or any of that stuff. I mean, you've got plenty of other people who are talking about those things here today, I think. Okay, so there are various papers. I mean, this is just to thank the people who've done this work with me, various people at Warwick and elsewhere. And to point you at the literature, there is quite an extensive literature now, both on this idea of reforming shocks, what happens when you go to higher Mach numbers, and also an extensive literature on quasi-perpendicular shocks, both in terms of simulations and in terms of data analysis. So the basic picture, and several speakers this morning kind of alluded to this already, is the following. When you think about a quasi-perpendicular shock, you have the upstream flow coming in, and it's always going to be coming in from the left here, okay? And you have the problem that you have to do something to collisionally heat the ions as you go across the shock. So collisionlessly heat the ions. And so what you find is that a subset of the ions coming in move straight through the shock and are slowed, so the bulk velocity goes down, but there's no significant heating. And then another subset of the ions are reflected at the shock front. They gyrate. They gain, if the thing is static, basically they specularly reflect here, so they see the oncoming electric field associated with the background magnetic field, and they pick up that velocity, so they just reflect and they gyrate. Then they are transmitted through on the next trip, okay? So the magnetic field goes up here. This population of ions perturbs the magnetic field, so you get a foot region in the magnetic field upstream. And downstream, you get some oscillations in the magnetic field, because now you have this non-background population of ions sloshing around in the phase space. And this picture comes from kinetic simulations in 1D, 2D, 3D, and so forth. And also observations that we have from the solar system. Okay. Now, the thing is, as has been mentioned, this is the sort of picture you get if the Mach number is sufficiently low, or the plasma beta, the upstream temperature, is sufficiently hot. And so we want to kind of go outside of this a bit. So bearing that in mind, okay, just to orient you here, what I'm talking about, because, you know, the coordinate system and so forth, as I say, the shock is coming in from the left. You have, this is our 1.5D picture now. So the field is going to be enhanced across the shock. I'm going to be looking at things varying in this direction, but we have all vector components of the field. We have to be a little bit careful about that, what that means, because things only vary in X to V is zero. If I choose components of the magnetic field upstream, here it's just perp, then it has to be perp downstream. So if I have an oblique solution to this and I have a component of B here, it's the same through the shock, okay? And that's because it's in less than three dimensions. I'm also throwing out an awful lot of wave physics here, because K has to be along the direction of the simulation. So as you introduce more dimensions in these simulations, what you're doing is introducing more K modes, so you can have more waves, more instabilities, more interesting physics. So this is the minimum physics that one can do perpendicular shocks with. So as I say, this is PIC code, so there's some details here, but basically, this is just to kind of stress the difficulties with PIC simulations and the compromises that are made. And it kind of matters when you try and interpret the results, and particularly when you try to scale things, okay? Because what one is trying to do, of course, is follow ions and electrons by Lorentz force law and update fields via the Maxwell equations. It's straightforward enough. So you need to represent all those space and time scales in the simulation. So what is typically done is, well, you know, we can't run this thing forever, so we have to compromise. And here I'm going to choose, you know, the wrong mass ratio for ions to electrons. But there's another important ratio, and that's the plasma frequency to the cyclotron frequency, okay? And so typically what's done when people do PIC simulations, you kind of cheat with one or both of these. And here we're cheating with the mass ratio. And now this affects the sort of instabilities that happen. You may see some nice streaming instability in the simulation for the non-realistic mass ratio. And when you get the realistic one, it goes away. And so you have to kind of worry about these kinds of issues. So it's very difficult to just put these to the relevant parameters. And so what's been done in the literature, where people have got the right mass ratio, often they've had to compromise on this number instead. So there are difficulties, but they're not insurmountable, but they're just something to be aware of. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about, I'm basically going to present stuff which has in mind supernova remnants. Okay, so I'm going to start by doing alpha Mach number of about 10 simulations for different incoming plasma betas. Then I'm going to show a few results by putting in some alpha particles as well, because of course we want to worry what happens when we put heavies in. Again, that's slightly tricky with simulations because you're using particles, and particles you want to statistically represent things properly by mass, and so it's quite hard to put the heavies in a way that preserves the phase space properly. Okay. So I probably won't talk about pickup protons because I think I won't have time, but if people are interested I can talk afterwards. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is this picture, as I say, of reforming shock. So I'm taking that standard picture, doing a PIC code simulation, but up at Mach 10. And what you find is, instead of having a nice steady shock, the thing becomes time dependent, and you can see that here. So what we're looking at, remember, flow's always coming in from the left. This is the direction of the simulation, and this is time. And so this is a stack plot of magnetic field magnitude. So this is your upstream region. And what happens is we get these repetitive peaks in magnetic field, and you can see this stuff here. This is the foot region of the shock. So this is just like our sort of standard picture of the shock where you have the foot and the ramp, but the thing is reforming, and it's reforming on ion scales, okay? So on the right here, we're looking at phase space. So what that is, this is direction along the shock. We're following the shock here, and this is the x velocity, the velocity, so it's, you know, it component in the direction of the shock. And so you can see here the protons are coming in, they're hitting the shock here, and they're reflecting. Some are going straight through, but they're doing it in a kind of bursty fashion, okay? And so the energization, you can see the energy here, they come in, they're reflected, and here you can see the foot region forming, you can see it here as well, and then a bunch reach quite reasonable sort of energies, and then they go downstream. Here you can see things that look rather messy, okay? This messiness is to do with the fact that now we have these non-thermal protons and they're strongly perturbing the magnetic field. But it's not a good simulation of turbulence because, as I say, we haven't put all the physics in that you'd get in higher dimensions, but you do scatter the protons. So if we look at the energies we get here, they're basically scaling with the injection energies you'd expect, because the energy that you get for these ions as they reflect is something to do with the formation of the shock, and then they just move in the foot region. So the scale of this process is to do with this foot region, which is an ion scale. So our guess is that ion scales are sort of controlling the physics of this acceleration process, but that's something we'd like to check. Okay. So, as you heard this morning, when in this classic sort of stationary shock picture, the ions that get reflected, the few that get reflected, come from a certain place in the phase space. They just happen to be the ones that are going slowest when they reach the stationary shock front, because then the shock potential reflects them back. And you can see this, you can actually diagnose these things in simulations, and this is quite an old, a classic paper that did this for the stationary shock solutions, the sort of thing you'd see in the solar system. So all that's done here, again, it's the same picture, X against VX, but you can split the incoming distribution in terms of where you are in phase space. So the core of the distribution, the coldest particles are here and the hottest are here. And you can see the coldest ones go straight through and the hottest ones are heated. So we can now ask the question, is the same sort of process going on in the reforming shocks by making the same plot? And the answer is no. Now you can see from the core or from the edges of the distribution, everything's reflected. And the reason this is happening is because really what's controlling this is just the shock is coming and going. So when the shock is maximum, things reflect. When it dies away, they all just go straight through. So really what happens to these eyes just depends upon, you know, this cyclic behavior of the shock. Now, this is another way of looking at this. Again, it's exocrine increasing time. And what we've done is go into the simulation now and pick out different ions, ones that stay at fairly low energies and ones that reach quite high energies, and see where they come from, because you can go back and trace them through the simulation. So these are, they're not test particles, they're from the population of simulation particles. And ones that get to fairly high energy, the black guys are all coming in here, there's a bunch of them, and you can see what happens. They come into the shock when it's got significant amplitude, they reflect, they all move along the shock front, gyrate, and then they go through. And the important thing is they stay in a little bunch. So clearly it's just they happen to arrive at the right time when the shock is very strong and they reflect. Whereas lower energy ions arrive either before or afterwards, and that they're in different colours, green and a sort of purpley colour. So it's a fairly simple picture of what's going on. Shock flapping up and down, ions come in, they reflect, they gyrate. And here's a picture of the trajectories now. Now, we're in the downstream rest frame, so you've got to imagine as this ion moves along, the shock is moving this way. So this is a high energy ion, comes in, it reflects at the shock front, gyrates, moves along the shock front, gains a bit of energy, and then it's in the downstream region. Okay, so its energy, it now forms a kind of a ring, and it sits around velocity zero because we're in the downstream rest frame. Okay, whereas these are ions that reach lower energies, and you can see some of them sort of do almost the same thing, like this guy, it comes in and it kind of reflects and jiggles around a bit. The only difference between this guy and this guy is that this one never makes it back upstream. So it goes in, gains a little bit of energy, but it's always in the downstream region. So it never gets into the foot and can move in the electric field and gain energy. Okay, so now what we'd like to do is say, we think we sort of understand this. It's really got something to do with the fact that ions come in. As long as they're reflected, and we don't care how particularly they move in the foot region, their time that they spend in the foot region depends upon ion scales. The energy they gain must somehow depend upon ion scales. But there's a lot of electron physics in this simulation as well that's kicking around the fields. And so in order to scale this up, we want to figure out whether we need to worry about the electron physics. And again, we can go back to the code and test a few ideas. So what I'm doing here is testing the idea of whether you only need to worry about physics on ion scales to understand the ion energization. So what we've done, obviously in the code you have all the electromagnetic fields, and so I can take a particle and I can follow a trajectory and I can work out the integral of V dot E along the trajectory and look at its energy gain. So I can just do that with all the fields in the code, and that's kind of this fuzzy plot here, the light grey. And then I can go back and say, well, let's take the equations of motion. This is, okay, for particles, and take a low frequency limit. So we'll throw away all the electron physics. So we'll throw away electron inertial terms, displacement current, we'll assume everything's quasi-neutral. And that gives me an approximate value for the electric field as if we were only looking at ion physics. And I'll take that, work it out from the simulation, compute this and compare it. And so if we look at the energy gain here, integral V E dot E, you can see they pretty much track each other for high energy ions. So in other words, the high energy ions don't seal the details of the electron physics. There's another way of looking at that here, this is minus potential. Okay, so we potential, i.e. integral of E dot dx, again along a trajectory, and the light grey is just what you'd get from the simulation including everything, and you can see there's all this stuff, but if you compute it just thinking about ion physics, it kind of smooths it out and it tracks it, except here and here, and that's just where the proton interacts with the shock, interacts once, gyrates, and again. So if we want to know about ion energetics, we don't have to worry about electrons. And that's quite useful because we're probably not getting the electrons right because we haven't got the right mass ratio. I'll come back to that in a moment. So now we can say, okay, we understand that, we're going to scale it up. And so you take your simulation, you double the mass ratio, or you double the injection speed and convince yourself you understand the scaling, and then kind of cross your fingers and put some big numbers in. And so that's what we're doing here. We're saying, okay, we think that the characteristic time scale just goes like 1 over the cyclotron frequency of the ions, and the characteristic length scale just goes like the injection velocity over the ion cyclotron frequency, because it really is ions just coming in and reflecting, and so they're just gaining energy proportional to the injection velocity. Okay, plug it all in and scale everything up. So we're going to now go to proper mass ratio, proper injection velocity, and put in some numbers. And if you do that, then you can make some estimate of the energy you might get for larger Mach numbers, provided you still get these reforming solutions. And as I say, you can only tell to a certain extent, of course. I mean, we can test this scaling with simulations by doubling the mass ratio or doing it times four, but that's about as much as you can do. So we've done that, but beyond that, you're crossing your fingers a little bit. But nevertheless, we can see how this thing varies, and it really just goes with the injection energy. No. Because I haven't done it properly. I mean, this is really the energy you just see downstream of the shock. So there's a whole extra bit of physics afterwards that would determine the spectrum. But it gives you something as a sort of input to that calculation, I guess. Okay, so having got this simple picture, now we're going to put some more physics in and see if it, you know, messes things up. And so there are many things you can do, and this is just one of them. Start putting heavier ions into the incoming population. And so again, this is this plot, distance, you know, across the shock against time, this magnetic field magnitude plot. And I'm starting to add alpha particles, okay? Again, I'm only doing alpha particles because, you know, the bigger the mass of the particles, the more computational particles you need per density, and so it gets very computationally expensive. Anyway, at 4%, not much of a different story. You can still see this thing cyclically coming and going on the ion proton period. But as we start increasing the percentage of alpha particles, things start getting all messy. And you can see, particularly at 25% here, you get these quite long runs where it almost looks stationary, and then it goes and does something else. Because what we're doing here, of course, is introducing an extra time scale into the problem. So, you know, the alpha particles here are now starting to determine the time scale of the shock. So again, this is, I haven't had a chance yet, this is very preliminary, to go and trace particles through and do all this business again. But it kind of tells you there's a whole extra nice problem there to do. What we can do, though, is ask, what's the distribution look like? And is it any different? Because I haven't shown you distributions yet. So we're computing, I mean, as I say, I don't have spectra, but I can go and look in the simulation and get the distribution locally, or just at the shock, which is what's done here. So the black line here, this is the protons. Down here we have the alphas. The black line is when we just have protons on their own, okay? So these are all just exponential, okay? They're not power laws or anything that you'd expect. As we start to add alphas, first this drops, and then it starts to go up. So adding these alphas actually gives the protons more energy, and I don't quite know why yet, actually. So that's quite interesting. The other thing I want to talk about is, well, what happens to the electrons? I've said nothing about electrons yet. Well, first of all, looking at this kind of plot, this is the same plot what happens when you add the alphas, but I'm looking at electrons now. So this is just protons on their own, and 4%, 10% and 25%. And you can see there's a different story going on here, that I'm doing something to the shock that's just giving the ions more and more energy, but actually it isn't to the electrons after a certain point. So probably the electron physics is a bit different. So I'll just say a little bit about what it is. What I'm going to say about electrons is a lot more tentative than the ions, because I don't think I can scale it, and I'll explain why, okay? But anyway, it's a nice bit of physics, and it may be useful. So what we have here is a snapshot. Again, it's the phase space. It's the thing I showed you the movie of earlier, okay? And we're now looking at protons here. So this is, again, a long going into the shock, and this is x momentum. So you can see the incoming population coming in, reflecting at the shock ramp and forming a foot region and doing all its thing, and then gyrating around downstream in a messy fashion. And you see there's actually a lot of detail in here, and you know, it was hard to see in the movie, so I didn't mention it, but, you know, something rather interesting. And this is the electrons now, same thing, coming in. In the foot region, you see there's quite a lot of electron heating going on. In fact, in this little simulation, most of the heating is going on in this foot region because it doesn't get any fatter downstream, okay? What I'm going to do now is zoom in on this little region right here, and that's done here. So here's the ions coming in, and this is the ramp of the shock, and this is the foot region. So what we have here is a nice little streaming instability. because the reason this is happening is the incoming distribution is sufficiently cold, okay, it interacts with the backstreaming distribution. You're forming these nice little structures in the phase space. And if I look at the electrons, you can see here, and there's this one right here, and maybe just here, you form these wonderful little phase space holes. Now what these mean is that you can trap particles in here, not ions, as we've hopefully shown, but we looked at the ion behavior and the ion energetics in the foot region, and we very carefully asked, well, does it matter about all these little details in the electron scales? And we came to the conclusion, no. So this is not going to affect the ion motion. These ions, okay, they get a bit messy, but basically they just do that on the average, and they're nice. Okay, I'm nearly done. They're nice little reflected motion in the foot region, gain a bit of energy and go downstream. But the electrons are going to get caught up in here. And the thing to bear in mind here is we're looking at the X motion here, but things can also go in Y, and we have an electric field in Y, which is just the V cross B electric field. So let's see what happens to electrons. A little movie. So we're following to high energy, electrons that get to high energy, as they come up to a little phase space hole, and they get trapped and jiggle around, and then off they go. Okay, so where did all this energy come from? Well, it came from going in the direction perpendicular to what you're looking at, i.e. in Y. And we can see that here, if I show you some plots of the electron trajectories. So again, this is with time, okay, and this is PY, so they kind of come in and then spin Y, get a bit of energy, and here they're now gyrating where they were doing all this business around the field. And here's the energy against X as we go through the shock. So you can see those two particles gain a little bit of energy, and they get that by moving in Y. And then this meandering is the electrons, now they've got a bit of energy, being scattered around in the local kind of turbulent fields, okay? So as I say, I wouldn't kind of rely on getting any measurement out of that stage, but, you know, that's kind of tells you what needs to be modelled next. Okay, so that's how a streaming instability can accelerate the electrons. But I've been very sort of cagey about this because we haven't got the right mass ratio. And so what I wanted to show is, say, two things. One is this is depending upon the formation of phase space holes. And we only grow these phase space holes if we get the streaming instability. We only get the streaming instability, well, one control parameter is having a cold upstream distribution, okay? So what I've done here is look at the energy, the distribution of the electrons in that region as a function of beta. And so here we have a fairly low value of beta and they're gaining energy, phase space holes. When we have a higher value of beta, this nice tail disappears because the phase space holes aren't there anymore, okay? So it depends on where the instability goes, and that depends on the mass ratio. Okay, so to conclude, what have we said? Okay, I've looked at the very simplest case, which is a perpendicular shock in 1.5D. As I say, there's a lot more physics one can put in, but it's quite useful to even ask questions about what you get in the simplest case and then build on that. Okay, and if you do that, and then you ask, well, what happens as we start to increase the Mach number or decrease the upstream plasma beta, then you start getting these reforming solutions, which is interesting because it gives you a bit more energy than you'd get otherwise. Okay. As I say, the relevant parameter is basically making the upstream, the amount of energy in the spread in velocity in the beta low compared with the injection velocity, which is why this comes on at high Mach numbers. Okay, so if you do that, then you start to cook them in. I've put in a ballpark figure of 6, but as you saw, there's actually an exponential tail if you look locally around the shock. Okay, and then you could get some reasonable heating out. However, if you start doing things like putting in other species, then, okay, we'll have to rethink it because things get more interesting, and we're seeing actually more energization, and it's not quite clear why. I've got some ideas, but I'm not sure about it. The electrons, on the other hand, do this kind of surfotron-type acceleration, which means if there's a phase space hole, they can get trapped in it, and they can run along the Y electric field and gain energy. But this occurs if you have phase space holes. Now, this is the problem with the mass ratio, because having this mass ratio of 20 here favours this particular instability in the simulation. And there's quite a lot of literature on this where people have looked at different mass ratios and at different parameters space, and they do or do not get phase space holes. Or sometimes they get phase space holes for different instability, okay? Because more than one instability will grow these things for you. And so it's actually quite sensitive to parameters. So unlike the ions, where we kind of know how to scale the energetics, and you know, we're quite happy about that, the electrons are going to be a bit more sensitive. So you might find this process is switching off or switching on as you change parameters. So that's a bit of an open question. So, we've done some things with pick-up protons as well, but I'll talk afterwards at coffee or something if you want to know about that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I have speculated that the reason why we don't see a fraction of electron heating diminishing as we go to higher shock speeds is that the shock itself is becoming more turbulent, and that if you had more than one spatial dimension, you might quench the surfotron. You might quench the instabilities that occur ahead of the shock and diminish the electron heating. Is that plausible in your opinion?
There's lots of ways of switching it off, and that's one of them.
Okay.
The other way is just to change other parameters, which is why I was very cagey. I mean, the important thing that I take away from this is that the processes affecting ions and electrons are very different.
Yes.
And so therefore you wouldn't expect them to track each other as you change parameters, that's for sure.
Where was the other question? No more questions? Okay, yes. For these.
So given what you just said, is there any way to generate a Maxwellian out of this for the electrons or the ions?
No. Well, yes. I mean, you saw all that nice turbulent stuff downstream, which we aren't at all doing properly in the simulation. I mean, if you did that properly, then maybe, yes.
What's the spatial scale of all that turbulence downstream?
Well, the box is sort of tens of the upstream, you know, the large-scale gyro radii. But really, I mean, we don't treat that in the simulation for two reasons. One is we don't have all the plasma physics in there. I mean, particularly, you don't have, you know, alpha and ion cyclotron heating or anything like that in this simulation. Okay. But also, you can see you're going to need a large volume downstream, which means you'd have to have a much larger box. So you'd want to go to higher dimensions and have a much bigger box to do that. So I don't think it's necessarily the way you would choose to do it. Okay. But it needs doing, obviously, and there are things that are already done.
The other thing, too, is usually when you see people talk about collisionless shock simulations, they like to invoke names of all sorts of waves and instabilities and various things. Like they'll talk about whistling waves and hybrid.
Yep,
you didn't mention any of that in your talk.
No, I didn't.
So why?
Because it's perp. what you could do, even sticking with 1D, but it's a bit fishy, is that, you know, you put there's no component of magnetic field threading the shock, okay? And K is a long X. So you need a component of B along K to have Whistler and, you know, alphane, and so to have alphane ion cyclotron heating and all these things. I mean, I've kind of deliberately excluded these things just to kind of look at the simple physics. You put those back in, you get all sorts of extra heating. But actually, you need immediately to go to at least 2D to do that, because, you know, in 1D you only have this one K mode, and you've got a whole range of K modes. Okay. So I didn't talk about that physics at all, but, you know, you could sort of argue, well, actually, at least from sort of linear and quasi-linear theory, we kind of know some numbers for these things, and so one could, you know, make some estimates without having to do this sort of horsing or dancing thing. But to do the turbulence properly, you need to do, you know, diffusive problem properly, which, you know, it's just not done here. I mean, we're not trying to do that problem. Okay, need to pick. I'm not at all confident for the electrons, no. More confident for the ions, because, what we're saying is that, you know, if it's quasi-perp shock, we know from all sorts of observations that roughly what goes on is the ions come in, they reflect, they gyrate, and they go through. And what I've done is ask, well, what happens when you start to decrease the upstream beta? I mean, which effectively means increasing the upstream alpha mark number, okay? you know, what happens to the shock, and so you start to find these interesting things, and there is a long story as to why that is so. Okay, so as long as these things still hold, then you could scale up. But what you would like to do, and it's an open question, is of course go to higher dimensions. I mean, these reforming shocks have been found in 2D. You know, people have done 2D simulations, but I think the 3D problem is open. And of course, you'd like to do it to check, you know, and you'd like to do it for a number of, you know, mass ratios and velocities and things to check the scaling and all these things. So yeah, it's open.
Okay, if there's no more questions, it's tea now. Thank you.